MEPs have voted to urge the EU not to open the next phase of Brexit talks unless there's a major breakthrough. A motion in the European Parliament to back a delay in any decision over trade discussions was supported by 557 MEPs, with 92 against and 29 abstentions. The result was something of a foregone conclusion after last week's fourth round of negotiations, when Michel Barnier made it clear there were still stumbling blocks. Several MEPs claimed UK divisions were hampering the process, but UKIP's Nigel Farage accused the EU of treating the UK like a hostage. Fortunately, Tuesday's vote in Strasbourg wasn't binding, and it will be for the European Council to decide if sufficient progress on EU citizens' rights, the Irish border, and the exit bill has been made. And Theresa May's conciliatory Florence speech was seen to thaw relations. Barnier said it was constructive. Tusk said the UK had realised it couldn't have its cake and eat it. That's détente sorted. But as far as trade goes, Theresa did a better job of saying what the UK's model wouldn't look like, rather than what it would. And it's a scary world. One inhabited by Donald Trump, who's already haranguing a deal between the UK and the EU to divide valuable agricultural import quotas. He wants to open up the UK food market to American products. Where's the good faith, Donald? So much for a beautiful trade deal. The WTO is clearly a world of self-interested nation-states and confusingly complex tariff rate quotas. Maybe the UK could simplify things by, say, joining a regional bloc of countries that negotiate as one. William Bain is a trade and Brexit expert at the British Retail Consortium and a former Labour MP. He distilled the subtle botanicals of international trade in a post-Brexit world to a decidedly English-tasting gin. Now, who's exporting tonic water?
Hello.
Hey, William.
Hi there, how are you?
Yes, very well, thank you. How are you?
Good, good.
Where shall we start? Let's start with Florence. Theresa May went to Florence supposedly to break the deadlock in negotiations, as well as heal her own party divisions, I suppose you could say. She was conciliatory in the tone that she took, and Michel Barnier called the speech constructive. But yet here
okay.
We are. The European Parliament resoundingly decided not to progress the talks. So what's gone wrong?
Well, I think it's important to remember the European Parliament's role is advisory during the negotiations. It has a very important role at the end, of course, when it can say yea or nay to any deal which is reached. But the key players at this point are the Commission. So I think perhaps it was more interesting to look at President Juncker's remarks and, of course, the European Council. And the Commission will make a recommendation to the European Council on the 19th of October. The European Council could decide, as the body representing all 27 of the other EU heads of government, that sufficient progress has been made. I mean, you know, it's not a term that is particularly well defined in Article 50 or any of the guidelines or documents since then. So inevitably, there's a lot of politics within it. But it comes down, I think, to two things. Has the UK managed to come forward with any convincing, compelling case about funding commitments that were made as 28, which going forward after transition will have to be met by 27? And secondly, is there significant progress on terms of enforcing the rights of EU 27 nationals who will be living in the UK afterwards? And this is really fundamental, I think, to the sort of EU's legal order, because it's all based upon, you know, rights that individuals can take from treaties and enforce in courts, you know, that they're beyond the ability of national parliaments to amend by their own legislation. And I think this is really fundamental to the concept of what the EU is. So there's got to be progress in those two areas. I think in terms of the Irish border issue, it's inextricably linked with what the final settlement is in any case. So there's likely to be some finessing of that in terms of stage two. I mean, my sense is the most that the UK can get out of the European Council in October is some kind of permission to move forward in terms of discussing transition now. I mean, bear in mind, we've got the financial services community today saying transition agreement has to be well progressed by Christmas, or else, you know, companies are going to have to activate their contingency plans and look at relocating part of their businesses elsewhere. So we're getting to the really serious pinch point where businesses have to look at their investment plans for 2019, and they will be considering whether to maintain all of their investment in the UK or whether to look further overseas.
It's crunch time.
Well, it is. I mean, that's the way business works. whether it's financial services, whether it's retail, construction, manufacturing, people looking at supply chains, they have contracts, and contracts have significances. So contracts have consequences and clauses for failure within them. So, this next 3 to 4 months is absolutely vital for the UK to be able to show it is going to be able to deliver a transitional deal that will work for business, and also that it has an idea about what the final relationship will look like. That is the other element that I think perhaps wasn't there as much in the Florence speech as could have been. I think the Prime Minister was quite clear about what her government didn't want. It didn't want the Norway approach. It didn't want the Canada approach. But what does the United Kingdom want? What is the preferred model? I suspect this is something that the Cabinet is going to have to iron out over the coming months. And unless there's a sort of clearer indication on that, then both the Commission and the European Council will say, well, what are we negotiating with? You know, what are we engaging with in terms of the final plan? So I think we need progress in terms of stage one negotiations with the Commission, but also I think the UK has to work out what exactly it's looking for in terms of the final relationship.
You've done my segue for me. My next question was literally on that topic. From Florence we learned less about our prospective trade model and more what it won't be. Not Norway, not Canada, somewhere in between. I wanted to ask you what you thought that meant, but secondly also, how can the UK hope to finalise and ratify that that model within the 12-month window that Mr. Barnier has set for initial talks to be completed?
Well, indeed. I think it's important to remember that the transitional agreement, if there is one, and remember it was just the Florence speech that was the first time that the UK gave formal notification that it wanted a transition. The Commission had already discussed about the mechanics of how that might be done if the UK did make a request. Bear in mind, that will be rolled up into the withdrawal agreement. So, we're likely to have two treaties. One certainly before Brexit, which is a withdrawal agreement that will cover the details of transition, potentially applying EU law for an additional 2 or 3 years or however long it's decided that that should run for. And then also, I think the final status agreement will be the basis of another treaty, but that's not going to be signed off or in a place to be ratified until well after we've left the European Union. Basically, in terms of the withdrawal agreement, it does have to be concluded by September in order that the European Parliament can have its vote, that the UK Parliament can have its vote. If it is a mixed agreement, I think the emphasis will be to try and make sure it isn't a mixed agreement. But if it is, then that would involve a degree of national ratification too, which would increase further complexity into it. Where do I think things are headed? Clearly there is a kind of spectrum of options between what we might call EEA minus and CETA plus in terms of what the final relationship might look like. I think EEA minus is believed to be the option which Philip Hammond and Amber Rudd and other figures in the cabinet support. And that involves a sort of high level of regulatory alignment, effectively mirroring EU legislation on food safety, product standards. And you do that in order to maximise the level of market access. I mean, this is effectively what Switzerland does in the sectors that it has access to the internal market. Now, that does mean that you're circumscribed in terms of what you can do in terms of trade agreements, because if you're basically aligning yourself in orbit to the EU, you can't, therefore, align yourself to US standards on things like food. So it does cramp the UK style a bit in terms of the trade agreements. But, most economists have sort of worked out the trade that we would lose from having regulatory barriers with the EU couldn't be made up by having even the strongest trade deal with the United States, and, you know, deals with ASEAN, Mercosur, you know, the BRIC countries. So, you know, I think in a sense, the key decision is whether people are going to favour and make paramount our access to the European market or some of these other trade deals. And I think that's where that faction of the cabinet is heading towards. There's another group, which Boris Johnson is within, probably also Priti Patel and Liam Fox, who want the ability to sort of depart in regulatory terms from European standards. They want to have you know, quite strong trade deals with other countries like the US. And so they're prepared to sacrifice some market access in order for the ability to diverge. So they see the Canada-EU trade agreement as a kind of starting point, but would want to significantly improve upon that. So I think those are kind of the two options that the cabinet's looking at. Now, it's interesting when you look at Parliament as a whole and, you know, the sort of shift in sort of Labour position and Labour messaging since the general election. And so options like staying in a customs union and even staying in the internal market have not been ruled out now by Keir Starmer or Jeremy Corbyn. And, you know, I think it's interesting to see, you know, how the numbers in Parliament will stack up on those options. So there is some pressure from Parliament, certainly that wasn't there in the same way before June, to keep those options on the negotiating table.
I mean, it's impossible really to talk about this without mentioning the cabinet divide that you've that you've just mentioned, and also potentially as well Labour's own, I would actually argue, lack of clarity perhaps on the issue, and that because you're talking about Jeremy Corbyn and his own long-held and pretty hard-held Euroscepticism, and how that's at odds with the sort of new swathe of voters that Labour's attracting in socially liberal metropolitan areas. It's very difficult for them to sort of vocalise that position. But also, perhaps most interestingly, is I think the cabinet divide, and particularly Boris Johnson parroting off every single weekend in a different national newspaper about his own opinions and his red lines on Brexit, essentially setting up Theresa May to fail in many ways. But perhaps most interestingly is the hard Brexit think tank that he's now set up with Liam Fox. What impact do you think the kind of exit that his half of the cabinet is advocating would have on the UK's future trade agreements?
Well, you know, I mean, I'm someone who, you know, tends to follow facts and figures and sort of rational argument, and I like to see evidence in front of me. And, you know, if you look at institutions like the National Institute for Economic and Social Research, the work that they've done, particularly Monique Abel, you know, you see that the more non-tariff barriers that exist between the UK market and the European market post-Brexit, the more trade we lose. Because the biggest driver of sort of trade growth has been, you know, the eradication of non-tariff barriers over the last 30 years. So if we set up barriers between ourselves on things like customs and, you know, regulatory checks on food, on plants, meat products, etc., cars, then we'll do less trade with Europe. Now, the question is, can these trade deals with the US, even just replicating what we have with Canada, South Korea, etc., can that make up for the trade that we're going to lose with the EU? And, you know, the National Institute have said it can't. And there aren't that many credible studies out there that say that you can. And I think we've even seen this week, you know, the sort of easy talk that it would be possible to get agreement from President Trump and get a trade deal signed immediately. You know, we've seen that's not been the case this week with the dispute between the United States and the UK and the EU over tariff rate quotas. And that's a harbinger that, you know, the US and other countries will play hardball. You know, they will look after their interests first and foremost. And it's not going to be as easy as people think to be able to, you know, get these deals done as quickly as possible, or in ways that will always favour the UK industrial position.
I'm glad you mentioned Monique Abel, because she's been a recent guest of the podcast, I think actually episode 98. But we also, you may remember Patrick Minford and her disagreeing quite vocally in an assortment of publications. He's also been on the podcast episode 99. I feel like I should give him his fair due, although you should probably listen to our listeners. You should probably listen to that episode rather than my substandard paraphrasing of his argument. But he essentially forecasted a hard Brexit with unilateral abolition of all trade barriers and much of EU regulation would boost Britain's GDP by about 6.8% or £135 billion. Judging by what you've just said, I'm assuming you disagree, but perhaps you could give us a little bit more detail on your assessment of his claims.
Yeah, I mean, it was very interesting. I mean, I think it sparked a great deal of sort of kickback from economists from other sectors. I mean, I was particularly taken by a piece that went on the sort of London School of Economics blog from the University of Groningen, which sort of compared a kind of hard Brexit, where there's a very weak deal on things like customs, with, you know, the best possible configuration of trade deals with the rest of the world, you know, the US, Mercosur, ASEAN, the BRICS, you know, the sort of oceanic countries, Australia, New Zealand, that we have traditional links with. And they found that even with that, UK GDP falls between, you know, 1.5% to 3.4% over a sort of period of a few decades in comparison with what we would have with having a really strong trade and cooperation set of agreements with the EU. So, you know, I come back to a kind of basic point, which is if you look at the way that trade's working throughout the world, there's a simple reason why nations trade most with the countries that are nearest them. It's called geography.
And the gravity effect, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I with respect to Patrick Minford's work, it did not pay sufficient account to the gravity effect, nor did I think it paid enough account to the fact that non-tariff barriers are where the biggest gains in trade come these days. And, you know, what we've got with the EU is a sort of harmonized system whereby you've got a single set of rules on products, competition law, a single set of institutions to enforce that, and, you know, it provides great certainty for business. It's as easy for someone to be a hairdresser in London as it is in Prague. And, you know, we've established very deep supply chains, particularly for aviation, for the automotive sector, but also for food as well. You know, there's ingredients from the EU27 that find their way into products that we eat every day here in the UK. So, you know, whatever we have is not going to be as good as that. But I think the real issue for the politicians and the front line these days is to discuss what we can have that protects as much of the economic benefits as possible. And that comes to this key point about how much are we willing to align in regulatory terms to the EU. I mean, I think, again, something we can say about global trade policy is, you know, there are really two, stretch three axes which countries orbit around in terms of trade policy. You know, one is the US, one is the EU, the other one coming up on the rails, maybe China. But there really isn't, you know, anything outside of that. So, you know, what countries are finding is aligning themselves around one of these axes is absolutely critical in terms of getting the lowest possible non-tariff barriers and having the biggest boost to trade and jobs.
You mentioned what I'm assuming is also an effort by the Trump administration to open up the UK food market to American products. We can come back to that, but the sort of the fiendishly complex tariff vote quotas at the WTO is something that a village idiot like myself struggles to understand. Perhaps you could first explain that system to us, and then we can come back to the recent news about Trump blocking the that move by the UK and the EU.
Yeah, well, tariff rate quotas are basically a system whereby, you know, an exporting country can bring in a certain quantity of product. I mean, it usually is in relation to food products. Either a zero tariff or at a very low tariff. So, for example, in terms of New Zealand lamb, there's a tariff rate quota of about 250,000 tons per year. And that means that New Zealand can import that amount into the EU at either zero or very low tariffs. If it imports lamb beyond that into the EU, beyond that in terms of quantities, then obviously it has to pay the kind of standard tariff, either under a trade agreement that it has, or in terms of what the most favoured nation rates are with the WTO. So in a sense, it's a trade concession that allows for certain food products to be imported at a lower or zero tariff. And I think the issue that's arisen this week is that the UK and the EU have decided in principle to sort of divide the current EU tariff rate quotas in terms of the product, how much product is consumed. So in terms of lamb, for example, it's the UK that consumes most New Zealand lamb. But what New Zealand and other countries like Thailand and the United States are concerned about is that they think that it will perhaps diminish overall access to the two markets, the UK and the EU market post-Brexit. And that's why they've opposed it. And the US has become involved in it as well, because one of the things that it wants to see from Brexit is more access to the UK market for its agricultural products, not less. And I think it's worried about the sort of direction of travel, about what it sees in this TRQ deal.
So, at least from my understanding, one of the big advantages for me, at least in my eyes, was that when the EU negotiates at the WTO, it is as a block of 27 countries. And 28. And perhaps we could...
Don't forget Croatia.
Never. Perhaps we could expect now that future visits to the WTO, this could essentially become the new normal for us, being, you know, subject to the whims of these bigger global trade players.
Well, indeed. I mean, your countries are going to play hardball. You know, New Zealand's playing hardball over its lamb industry. The US is going to play hardball over its agricultural industry. You know, countries will pursue their own interests if they are negotiating as individual countries. One of the things about, you know, when you negotiate as a trading bloc is that, you know, in a sense, you put the interests of the bloc first, as opposed to, you know, the interests of individual national producers. So, yeah, there will be a difference. I mean, I think the UK would have different negotiating priorities going forward. For example, on, you know, trade defence policy, it might not want to maintain some of the trade defences that, you know, it would inherit from the EU. I mean, on, you know, things like sort of, you know, oranges, those types of things where, you know, at the moment there's a very clear producer interest from Spain. You know, a future UK trade policy might want to be more consumer focused. So I think this is one of the areas where it will be interesting to see how much the desire of the UK to forge a more independent path will, you know, clash with its necessity to have as strong a deal as possible to access the European market, because there will be a trade-off between the two.
And Liam Fox actually over the summer did argue that that was happening in the UK, that sort of consumer products, I think he mentioned ice cream and swimsuits over the summer, had sort of industry goods that we could export at a better rate and better quantities. And since Brexit, we all know the pound has devalued significantly, lost 15% of its value against other currencies. The argument goes that this will lead to an export-led growth. Has that happened so far?
No, not in terms of manufacturing. And it's been unusual. Because normally, you know, for example, the 1980s, when there was a sort of 15% devaluation, manufacturing was sort of boosted significantly. So I think it does kind of speak to some of the kind of weaker structural problems within the UK economy right now, which is that our manufacturing base is lower than what it was three decades ago. Do we have the right industrial policy to think about what goods we are going to be able successfully to export and to get the supply chains and the, you know, the research institutes and the finance together to be able to do all of this? So I think Brexit is a hugely disruptive but big change moment to the British economy, and it needs a tie-up, not just in terms of trade policy, but in terms of industrial policy. You know, the investment structures for banks and for industry, It's a really sort of almost reset moment for the British economy in terms of some of these big structural forces. And I think that's something that I'm not quite sure that, the politicians in the front line have quite gotten as yet.
So how does this depreciation rank in the glorious pantheon of currency devaluations?
Well, it's not as much as it was in the mid-80s. It's approaching it. I think the big issue that's come with it has been the increase in the price of imports. And, particularly things like food. We import 40% of our food into the UK. So it's made imported products much more costly for UK consumers. And in terms of some of the sort of big ticket white goods iPhones or MacBooks or things like that, they're more costly for consumers to buy. So it's contributing, along with the squeeze in real wages, to a sort of tightening in living standards. And, that makes it pretty tough and makes for an electorate that feels pretty angry at the moment and, is looking for solutions on how to boost those living standards.
Yeah, absolutely. And you add inflation into the mix. And it's hardly surprising that we've seen such an increase in consumer lending.
Yeah, well, indeed, which the Bank of England is very concerned about. And we saw some concern also from the IMF yesterday about that too. So, one of the issues is that if the Financial Policy Committee of the Bank of England decides to, as it's consulting on at the moment, introduce more restrictive criteria on how much lending people can provide to individuals, then, that could have a major impact on the UK economy.
Brilliant. Look, mate, that's absolutely fantastic. You did half the work for me there in that interview, to be honest with you. You started talking about every single topic I wanted to ask you about before I could get there. Thank you for speaking to me. It's been a real pleasure, and you made my life particularly easy. So thank you very much, William.
All right, all the best.
The podcasts I mentioned with Patrick Mimford and Monica Bell are episodes 99 and 101 respectively. Do give them a listen. And if you want to carry on the conversation, you can get us on Twitter. I'm at Ollie Dugmore, OLIDUGMORE, or at William_Bain, BAIN. And as always, at Brexit Podcast. The Brexit Podcast has been brought to you by Tim Hemming, Jennifer Hahn, Warren Pohl, and Ollie Dugmore, with the theme music by the one and only Kevin MacLeod.